If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Big Ben Strong is on the board while Willer's getting booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard, here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. So what do we got going on? Oh, Putin was reelected in Russia. Any surprises there? Are there any surprises? Anybody? Oh, there's one surprise in the back row. Not really sure what. Anyway, so there you go. And announcements coming out. Brian Mulroney, of course, former Prime Minister of Canada, will be lying in state this week in Ottawa and in Montreal. That getting underway today, as I'm sure there'll be lots of tributes in regard to the past Prime Minister. What else we got? Yeah, this was kind of interesting in regard to the provincial carbon tax, which I'm not sure there is one. But of course, Premier Ford said there won't be, and then pointed the finger at Bonnie Crombie saying, well, but she'll have one. Now, Bonnie Crombie and the provincial Liberals have come out saying they reject any idea of a provincial carbon tax. However, they didn't say anything about Justin Trudeau's federal carbon tax and whether they're against that, which, of course, seven other premiers are. So it'll be fascinating to see what the official position is there once the dust all clears. And this was fascinating, too, coming out of Vaughan, Mayor Stephen Del Duca, who went up to become mayor of Vaughan after losing in the provincial campaign with the Liberals as leader. And many of those around him and in his area giving him the kudos as they're going to try to introduce some sort of legislation to try to get a handle on the protests that are going on in regarding to the war between Hamas and Israel. So obviously we've all seen lots of examples of how it gets out of hand. Of course, in Canada, you have the right to protest. But when you're intimidating people and harassing people in points of institutions or hospitals, how far do we have to go before this gets out of hand? If any of this had happened during the Freedom Convoy, boy, would that story be a heck of a lot more different than what it is now. It makes that look like a bouncy castle. So it'll be fascinating to see where that goes moving forward. And you know, obviously, if that has any teeth, if there's anything that can be done there. So there you go. That's what's coming up over the course of the afternoon. We hope you hang around with us. And again, feel free to jump on board any way you can. Still to come, changes to the Around the Bay Road Race are coming. We're going to talk to Ann Lewis, the race director, in regard to that. I think there might be more of a thigh burner, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it's longer. Hey, so here's the 1 year you decided to run around the bay, and I mean the whole thing, and then they stretch it out. What's with that? We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, Tim Power is going to be joining as chairman of Summa Strategies. This was fascinating over the course of the weekend. There was a BBC report that came out, which followed a media appearance in the French media with Justin Trudeau. And he talks about how he's he talks about his crazy job and in questions every day whether he's going to continue to do it or not, which is very bizarre. And again, something to come out from another part of the world, something that the Prime Minister said in Canada. So is this a change of strategy? Is this because, again, well, I'll leave it at that. Is this a change of strategy? Is he honestly mulling this over? Or is this, again, just reaffirming what his position is and that he's not going anywhere and he's going to ride this out and ride the game clock out until the next election? And again, I can see him doing that because, as happens in many elections, the opposition shoots themselves in the foot before they get to an election day. And we've certainly seen that happen with the Conservatives. So, you know, I can totally see Justin running out the game clock, per se, just to see what happens, you know, across the court. But that being said, I don't think that leaves the party in any better shape. I think they would be wise just to move on and at least give the Liberals a fighting chance in whatever they're trying to do in the next election. But we'll see what happens moving forward. We'll talk a little later. We'll talk a little later on with Colin DeMello from Queen's Park about the carbon tax provincially, what it means, and the comments by the politicians in regard to, is there really a tax? Is this just politics? We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. And an interesting article. Do you enjoy shopping? Because, you know, I know there's some people that really do. And they love getting out and, you know, especially when there's sales on or Black Fridays or Boxing Day sales or what have you. And they really get into, you know, the feeling in the event that is shopping. Well, is that still the case as, some retailers make it more and more difficult for people to enjoy the experience per se? And is it just something now that we have to get done? And once we get there, we don't want to pay the price anyway. We will have those discussions this weekend, another edition of the Around the Bay Road Race, and some changes. A couple of changes, but, you know, change is always good, especially it's for all the right reasons, you know, and why not enjoy it a bit more and make it a bit more of a challenge, huh? That's what it's all about. All right, Anna Lewis is with us, race director for the Around the Bay, gearing up, stretching it out for next weekend. Anna, hope you're doing well. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
So changes for this edition versus others. Give us a rundown. There's a couple of different changes here, is there not?
Yes, there's several changes. We're very excited. Our finish and start are going to be around Tim Hortons Field, whereas in the past, we've finished and started at First Ontario Centre. So we're kind of excited. It's our 130th anniversary, so it's a great year to kind of shake it up. There's a new course because of the venue change. So the 30K is now a 34K race. And that's mostly because we have to avoid train tracks. We're mindful of the streets that we're using so that we can continue to have services for the residents in the area. And we also removed relays, but now have 10K and 15K individual events. So lots of big changes, but very, very exciting.
And again, you know, change happens as things change around the course and such. But what's the reaction from participants? Because there's a lot of history here.
You know what? Surprisingly, I was a little worried, but we sold out the 34K in a month. We opened in October, mid-October, and we were sold out of the 34K in 1 month, mid-November. And the other race categories followed suit as well. The relays were very, very popular, but, you know, we recognize that those were good distances, medium distances that can bridge between 5 and 34. So they became very popular quickly, and they sold out just as well.
And obviously the distance doesn't change, I guess. Obviously the distance does change, but if you're a runner and you're into this, most are up for the challenge. I don't see anybody complaining about any of it.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do use the Bay Race as a warm-up race to a marathon. So yeah. Whether you're doing 34 or 30, when you're trying to gear up for a 42K marathon, you're going to have to hit that mark anyway. So historically, the Bay Race has been a warm-up race or a training race for Boston, for the Mississauga Marathon, the Toronto Marathon, Ottawa. So it's still perfect in the lineup in terms of the calendar year to set yourself up for one of those marathons.
And, you know, I mean, it doesn't hurt to take it in a different route, freshens it up a little bit, especially going around Tim Hortons Field and the neighborhood there.
Yeah, you know, that neighborhood has been so supportive of so many events. They just had the Grey Cup there and lots of, you know, concerts and big events. And I thought that was a comparable venue to First Ontario Centre, where it also hosts some great events and large scale events. So I felt like we can provide that same stadium experience at Tim Hortons Field.
So start and finish line there?
So the start line will be at Lockridge and Cannon. And okay. Then you'll finish inside on the field at Tim Hortons Field.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it was always cool coming into the First Ontario Centre. So, I mean, this is going to be equally as cool, don't you think?
I think so. And we're giving access to spectators to the field level. So you can come and cheer for your runner and participant right on field level at the corner of Beechwood and Melrose. You can enter.
And talk a little bit about the challenges in Heartbreak Hill. And is this a tougher course now?
Well, it is tougher because if you have participated in the race, you kind of know exactly when a heartbreak hill hits. So it's right. Usually at the 26K. So now it's at the 23, 22 and a half K. So there's much more to go after you hit the hill. And there is a sneaky hill near Bayfront Studios on Stewart. So that one has never played in the course before. And that's a hill that's going to sneak up on you too and present a challenge for sure.
It's going to be interesting if this in any way changes what would have otherwise been the outcome of the race, if this adds more challenge to it.
Well, it will. I believe it will. But, you know, this race has never been easy. It's always for, you know, the winter warriors that are able to go out and train in the winter to conquer hills. So it's, you know, the wind, it's never been an easy race. So I do think that when someone finishes this race, they will feel a great sense of accomplishment and they will have done something very, very challenging.
Okay. So obviously you're sold out, you're ready to go. The people that just want to show up and watch and cheer on, what can we do?
Hey, come to Tim Hortons Field. There's three sections that face the finish line. And it would be so great to have the stands filled for those finishers. Along the route, we've had such great community support throughout the years. You know, different stretches have their own little character, like Beach Boulevard has Tin Pan Alley, where the residents come out with their pots and pans. York Boulevard has the Grim Reaper. Plains Road has the church choir. So come out and pick your spot and maybe start a new tradition there.
All right, Anna Lewis with us, race director around the bay, and this year's edition ending up in Tim Hortons Field. Anna, good luck with it this year.
Thank you.
This was kind of interesting, and you know, I've said this before about not only federal politics, provincial politics, but even municipal politics. You know, and even doing this job, you see even municipal politics. Every time you go out, they're there, they're doing something. It's a lot of shaking hands and kissing babies. It's a lot of time, and it's pretty stressful at times. And I really do believe when they get into it, they all want to try to do the right thing. And of course, we know where we are federally with politics and how you feel about that in Canada. Interesting report coming out of the BBC, but originated in the Quebec media. And the Prime Minister said, I think about quitting every day. It's a crazy job I'm doing, making the personal sacrifices. Of course, it's super tough. It's very, very challenging at times. And I don't think anybody would agree or disagree with that. And I don't think anybody holds that against the Prime Minister. But I think what stands out in this for me is I think about quitting every day. And I wonder, did he think about quitting every day, say, 2 years ago? I don't know. To talk more about all of this, let's bring in Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data, and here now. Tim, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
God, we're going to play psychologist today. Are we dive into the mind of Justin Trudeau to figure out what that means? Now, is that the one, the article, too, where they're claiming the translation was wrong as well? I'm lost on all of these different articles that came out over the weekend, but we'll do whatever you want.
Again, you know, it's a tough job, and I don't think anybody denies that the guy makes sacrifices and what have you. My point that stood out for all of this is I think about quitting every day, and I'm not sure that can get lost in translation. I think there was a boring phrase that was lost in translation, maybe.
Right.
But anyway, do you think that maybe he thought about quitting every day 2 years ago? I mean, is this a difference? Does that stand out for you?
I don't think he would have seen him say this 2 years ago. So, yeah, and maybe he was. Maybe when your prime minister woke up in the morning and say, this is great, but it's not so great. But I think, look, it's obviously more acute because it's a real conversation now, and it wasn't a real conversation 2 years ago. We talked about this last week. Then this thing, he's coming up next month on 10 years leading the Liberal Party, and it's no movement in the polls that works in his favor. They've been worse or not, you know, not any great shakes on any of the things they've done recently. And he's got his own family to manage. As we know, they publicly acknowledge they're separated, and somebody who is who co-parents and all of that. And I'm sure lots of your listeners are the same boat. It's not easy. So it's probably more real. I think your assertion is right there. It's probably more real than it has been.
Is this a changing of position? In other words, are people going to look at this and think, wow, he's even questioning whether he's going to stay on or not? Because, again, it's not about the toughness of the job. Not only that, it's the plummeting in the polls.
There might be a part of them that thinks it's humanizing. And frankly, that used to be his strength, right? Now it seems to be his weakness because nobody views him, or I shouldn't say nobody. He doesn't have the political credibility that he once did. So I wonder if it's a bit of both, you know, trying to humanize it, seeing if that has a political feel and it's also real. I mean, you and I talked about this last week when he said, you got to do hard things. There's been some things he said in the last week, maybe 10 days, that you wouldn't have expected him to say. So maybe there are some signs that he's either, you know, going to get hell-bent and stubborn and determined to, you know, just haul it out, make it all about his legacy, or maybe these are a little bit of foreshadowing that for people who are interested in replacing him, that the time is coming.
Does this stuff just happen, Tim, or is this planned? Even statements like this, or do they just come out during a chat?
It depends on the interviewer, right? And the comfort you have and where you are. Some of it's planned. But Trudeau's strength and weakness has been sometimes he lets things out in moments that maybe he doesn't want them to come out. So I don't know. I haven't seen enough evidence yet to say it's planned. What I have seen evidence of is a bit of a change of tone in the last week. So whether it was deliberate or it helped reframe the tone, I don't know.
He feels the pain too, or he feels his pain, as somebody put it. That being said, does this look like he's playing the victim, or is he saying, you know what, I get you don't like me?
Probably a bit of both, right? You know, like I'm sure he should be getting that people aren't as fond of him as he once was. I don't think he's politically astute enough to know there isn't a huge appetite out there for people thinking he's a victim. I mean, he still has the prime minister's job, which is a prestigious job. And yes, it's tough and all of that, but he's had it for 8 years and he's paid well and he's benefited enormously from it now. He will benefit it from it afterwards. So I'm not sure he fits into a victim motif, Scott.
Liberals launched new ads against Pierre Poilievre. Do these have teeth? Is it too little too late? How do you position any of this?
I think with him, it's too little too late, to be honest, unless there's a major slip. I think, again, this is probably their last big push as it relates to the prime minister, and he himself might decide. I think, again, they're looking at he's looking at his 10-year anniversary mid-April. He's looking at his budget on April 16th. Trying to figure the way through here, right? And then depending where he stands, you may see more pressure come upon him, or he may just decide himself, you know, for the good of the Liberal Party, I need to step off. That feels more like it is, to be blunt, here in Ottawa right now. I get that feeling more often. I had a senior Liberal suggest this morning something more openly than he has before about the Prime Minister's future. So there's certainly that mood.
Do you think it will be positioned, you know, this is what's best for me, you know, I've just run my course, I'm out of gas, I can't do this, as opposed to the party's failing, this is the best thing for the party?
Probably a bit of both. Like, I think, you know, everybody has their time, and he'll say, look, I'm stepping down for me, but this allows the party to renew, and you should look at a renewed Liberal Party, because that'll be better than your opponents. That's how I suspect it will go.
Timeline, or again, you know, at one time we were saying, hey, he's just going to run it right to the end. He's going to run the clock out. But then we keep talking about this. So does it change daily, or is he just going to run it to the end? And for the next, let me tell you here, 581 days, we're just chasing our tail.
As you know, I was an early adopter to he won't make it till the end of his term. Then I thought, okay, maybe he will. I'm now back that he's going to go. I'm a weather vane on this right now. Again, it just feels like here in Ottawa that the passion for staying is less, unless they somehow manage some miraculous change in the polls over the next 2 or 3 months. driven by their budget, it's hard not to see him. Why would you want to stay around if you know you're going to get your teeth kicked in and you're going to lose? Like, you don't, he can step off and do very well in the private sector now and still have a legacy of sorts that he can try and rebuild or build.
All right. The budget will be the telltale sign, I guess. Tim Powers with us, Chairman Summa Strategies, Managing Director at Abacus Data. Tim, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
Take care, buddy. Bye.
You know, we'd love to talk to the pollsters and gauge the mindset of where Canada is at any given time. And it was fascinating doing it over the course of the global pandemic. And now, especially where we are now, and it isn't quite the roaring 20s that we all kind of thought it might be when we were closed up behind the barn doors during all of that. Are Canadians becoming more optimistic about what is coming in 2024? Oksana Kishchuk with us, Director of Strategy and Insights with Abacus Data, and here now. Oksana, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Thanks so much for having me. Doing pretty good for this Monday.
So, and here we go on to Monday. Should we really be talking about this? We still are carrying this cloud, it appears, Oksana. What is it going to take to change the headspace of where Canadians are? Give us some insight here.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a lot. I think the financial picture is really what's dragging people down, both from kind of that big picture lens about what's happening in the economy, interest rates, but also the trickle down impacts that it has on everything from our hopes and dreams of owning a house to the cost of groceries when we pick them up. So really, really optimistic way to kick off the conversation there.
So, are you surprised that people's opinions have changed so dramatically in such a short period of time? Or I guess, is that just all the fallout of a post-pandemic era and the things that followed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's we've seen quite a bit of a slide in people saying the direction of things are going well. And it really started to take a dip last summer and has kind of remained in that pessimistic camp for some time. And I think during the pandemic, I think maybe there was some, well, this is a crisis and we have to band together and we'll just get through it and we'll come out on the other end. But I think here we are out on the other end and folks are seeing a country and an economy that isn't really what they had in mind for all of the sort of suffering and sacrifices that they made during the pandemic.
It's amazing how our priorities have changed. And I'm looking at your research, the ongoing housing crisis, and 68% believe the housing crisis is going to worsen in 2024. It's amazing how many people are concerned about housing.
Yeah, it's one of the sort of the top issues, I think, whether or not you currently hold a mortgage, whether or not you're looking to have a mortgage and own a house, or even I think right now the impact is being felt on renters with interest rates being high for so long, really starting to affect sort of the cost of even finding a rental apartment or house in a number of different cities in Canada. So really sort of driving that affordability conversation that I think is on the minds of so many of us right now.
And it really crosses generational lines because, you know, either you're trying to get one as a young person or your kids are trying to get one as a young person. But, you know, I think mm-hmm. what I found astounding, too, was you just assume that everybody thinks that you get your education, you get a good job and you start saving for a home. And this is the Canadian dream. But there's so many that just think this is not going to happen for them. And you have to wonder from a generational standpoint, you know, how long it's going to take to correct it and whether they will.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a generational problem from a number of perspectives. And when we ask people who aren't homeowners, kind of, do they believe that dream is alive? And over a third of them say no, they've given up on their believing that they're going to be able to purchase a home in the future. And so I think that's really sort of speaking to just how long folks have sort of been in this pessimistic slide and that it's getting worse and people are starting to sort of have their long-term hopes and dreams being shaped by the economic picture.
Will everybody have to see some sort of improvement in just affordability and such before they'll start to feel more positive? Because even we, you know, regarding housing, we hear this is going to take years and years to get out of, and so on and so forth. Do you think there is something that can happen that can change all of this, that can somehow, even a change in government, will that somehow create some hope and less despair, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Canadians are certainly looking to see some sort of action on it. I think they feel that sort of been in this slide for a long time, and governments and institutions maybe haven't stepped up in the way that they thought they would, or the way that they perceive that they have. And I think the environment for change and just maybe trying something else, because what is happening right now doesn't seem to be working for a lot of people. I think that mindset is becoming more and more prominent, in that even for elections, people are willing to try something different, or just say it's time for change, and we need to see if something else is going to make things better.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out in the next decade or so. Oksana Kiszczuk with us, Director of Strategy and Insights with Abacus Data. And optimism, is it there for the next year? Of course it is. There's always sunshine, but boy, there's some cloud too. Oksana, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
You might remember a while ago, Doug Ford came out and said that he would not have a provincial carbon tax. I'm not sure that there was ever going to be one. And then accused Bonnie Crombie as being the queen of the carbon tax, and that she would support this. The Liberals now have today come out and said if they form government in 2026, there is no provincial carbon tax. However, I believe stopped short of saying the same thing in regard to the federal carbon tax, which, of course, seven premiers are against at this point, which comes into effect April 1st, another edition of. Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief Global News. He's with us now. Colin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
This is sort of one of those, it's an issue, but it's not really an issue, because there really wasn't a provincial carbon tax I'm not aware of. So I guess that Doug Ford has said that he will not have that moving forward. And then he set the targets, the sights on Bonnie Crombie, saying that she would. Were you surprised to hear from the Liberals today that they're ruling this out?
Well, somewhat surprised and somewhat also not surprised. I mean, the federal Liberals have really gotten themselves into a lot of political hot water over this carbon price. And now the provincial Liberals don't want to get caught in the same trap, right? So now they're trying to distance themselves a little bit more from their federal cousins. I mean, everyone has seen the polls that Trudeau has. I mean, there are some projections that say that they could win just 55 seats in the next federal election campaign. So the Ontario Liberals are really looking at reviving their party. Remember, this is a party that was decimated in 2018, didn't do much better in 2022, and is now looking at really trying to have some kind of a political comeback in 2026, or they could find themselves in a really troublesome spot with Ontario voters. So if it's the case of dealing with, a really politically jeopardizing policy like carbon pricing, or just cutting off the appendage, I think that's what they're doing here. They're just saying, to heck with it. We're going to find a different way to achieve the exact same outcome, which is to reduce Ontario's greenhouse gas emissions.
She did, from what I understand, stop short of saying, agreeing with the other seven premiers who said they wanted a pause or a cut or anything on this to stop it from happening on April 1st. Did she comment on that at all?
Yeah, so that's right. So exactly what happened today was Bonnie Crombie is striking a new panel. A lot of Liberals on this panel, former cabinet ministers, one current MPP. And their task is to kind of come up with an election platform on the climate change file, right? What should Ontario do to address climate change and greenhouse gas emissions? Should it be a cap and trade system? Should it be some other way of really targeting polluters and targeting pollution? As part of that, she says Ontario was not going to consider, under her watch, a new tax on carbon emissions. But she is stopping short of really criticizing the federal government. What is really interesting here, though, is if you talk to some other liberals, they're saying that they are putting a bit of distance between themselves and their federal cousins, that, you know, they see the federal policy is not really bringing people along with them. And it seems to be they're indicating a bit of a failed policy. So they're trying to put a lot of space and not kind of carry along the federal liberal baggage along with them. But they're not criticizing the federal liberals. And that's the big definition point here, that Bonnie Crombie's still going to get a lot of questions, right? Okay, so you don't want to bring in a carbon tax. Well, do you agree with the federal liberals' carbon tax? And we haven't really heard that answer just yet today, but she's going to be showing up at Queen's Park tomorrow, and we'll definitely be getting that question then.
Are you surprised that she's jumping into this ring so quickly, or I guess to put out this fire? Do you get the feeling she's trying to bring the party back to the center after maybe Kathleen Wynne took it, like the federal party, a bit more to the left?
Yeah, listen, one day I had a sit-down interview with Bonnie Crombie when she was still running for the Liberal leadership, and she told me very clearly, she said, center, center-right. That is the, quote, secret sauce for success when it comes to gaining voters, right? You have to look at this from the political perspective that the Liberals are looking at this. They went to the left to chase the NDP vote, and they lost in two successive elections. So now they have to bring the party back to the center and try to court some of the progressive conservative policies, right, by being more fiscally conservative, yet socially progressive. And that's where Bonnie Crombie sees herself situating the party. And that's where they're trying to bring the party. What she's trying to do here with this carbon tax policy is to very quickly define themselves on a very unpopular federal policy. The progressive conservatives have been trying to frame Bonnie Crombie as the queen of the carbon tax. And she has to now very quickly set, you know, that expectation with voters that she's not going to bring in any type of carbon pricing policy that will impact voters, whether it's at the pump or at the grocery store.
Ontario Liberals rule out carbon tax if they form government in 2026. Colin DeMello with us, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. Watch tonight for more on all of this. As always, Colin, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks so much for having me.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right. We certainly know what has been going on with the polling of late, the last 6 months, 8 months or so. Obviously, the prime minister finding himself in difficult water, trying to make his way out. There's new fight or new liberals, new liberal ads designed to fight back. Are they going to work? Too little, too late? How do you change the tone when we are where we are? Let's bring in Muhammad Ali, vice president with Crestview Strategies, and here now. Muhammad, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
So your thoughts on this strategy, Muhammad, late to the game, a Hail Mary. What are your thoughts? Is it going to work?
You know, look, my feeling is like finally, like this is it was a pretty good ad. They needed a lot of this before. But look, it's never too late at this stage. Election is about a year and a half away. So, you know, they need to start at some point. So I'm glad they started. As people get closer to election, people start paying attention more. So it's good that they started launching this, because they need to do effective communications and effective attack ads to get back in the game.
At this point, is it about what either party says? Is it more about the reality on the ground? This is what we're feeling. This is what we're going through. And you can say what you want. Here's the affordability reality we're all living.
I think what the Liberals are trying to do is they need to paint him that he actually doesn't have the answers. In fact, he was part of the problem, because he has been effective. He, as in Pierre Poilievre, have been effective in painting that they had the solution and that they will come in and solve everything. The Liberals were the problem. And so everyone blamed the Liberals for the housing affordability. So by turning it back around, saying, look, actually, he was just part of the problem. He can't do it. He was a housing minister at one point and failed at it and didn't get anything built. So don't believe him. And by the way, here's the plan we're working on. So we're actually doing something. Even if you don't believe it, read about it. Here you go. Like, that's kind of the contrast and path that they will want to take in order to get back into the game around housing, being effective on housing.
Many have said that this is a communications issue for the prime minister, that you know, that's why they brought in a new communications team prior to Christmas and such. Is it really about the communication, or is it they really don't like the message, no matter how you position it? Because at the end of the day, the one thing that the prime minister was always good at was selling the message. I mean, he was a phenomenal brand. So is changing the brand the idea here? I mean, do we not already know what he's about? I think a lot of people after 8 years are thinking this is just a bad comms problem.
Look, I don't think there's a single liberal that will tell you that the communications from this government, its entirety, has been good. It has not been always effective.
Yeah.
And the purpose here is, like, you know, you're not trying to explain Trudeau. What you're trying to explain that, like, we're solving the problem, right? Because at the end of the day, one of the key things that are being taken away from the polls is that Canadians are believing that the government is not delivering what they want and need in addressing the crisis. So part of that is a communication. You can do all the work, but if people don't believe you're doing it, then, and you're not communicating it very well, it doesn't matter, right? So that is where they need to be more effective on the communication, because they are taking some pretty big action, and there's more to come, as I'm told, for more, because it's not going to, you know, you're not solving the problem today. But by allowing yourself to get back into the communications game and, like, cutting out the stuff that is putting you as not in touch, not effective, not delivering solutions, to actually saying, look, we actually are effective. Here's what we're doing, and here's how it's applying to you, and why the other guy is wrong, and why he's been part of the problem. Right? That's the thing that they have struggled with, is that last part. So if they can get in that last part, they have a chance, a real chance, to turn the page where someone might say, oh, actually, maybe I was wrong in my critique. Maybe I should give these guys a shot again to help solve this problem.
Are they trying to change the communication, or are they changing direction? Because, you know, we've seen a lot of about faces here, whether it's on immigration and the student caps. I mean, these are all self-inflicted problems that, you know, they show up with a solution afterwards. Is it really about communication of what we are and what we've been? Or is it, no, we've changed direction and people don't understand that?
So one of the things that a government, especially one that's been around this long, struggles with is explaining what they're trying to do and what they have a vision for. Because when you come in, you have a vision, you know, you have plans, and then after the first election, you know, you go into the first re-election, you still have, like, hey, we've done all this work, we're building towards that thing that we told you we were going to do. Well, now you're sort of having to pivot, right? Like, they never ran on a housing plan, they never ran on affordability, because these were not top of mind issues for the entire country as in 2015 or even in 2019. It was, you know, bubbling in certain markets. So they have to be able to reflect that we are responding to the issues of the day, because that's what people care about. Like, if you're not responding to the issue, you're not connecting that what your vision is on that, then they're going to lose faith in you and they're going to move away, right? Every government goes through this. So they have to be able to do that, and they have to be responsive, and that's what they're trying to do. So it may be deemed as a rebrand. You know, you're not going to be able to fully rebrand a very established brand like Trudeau's is, or, right, in his government. But what you can rebrand is that we are responding, we're active right now. We're not a lethargic government. We are an active government trying to figure out and address the solutions that you want.
Too much time spent trying to save the planet and not enough time spent trying to save Canadians or the middle class or those that are trying to join it. We all know the majority of Canadians are very concerned about climate issues and all want to do the right thing. But it seems if you don't agree with the prime minister, you're a denier. Is it too much time spent on issues that are not kitchen table issues?
There's a bit of that, right? Like, at the end of the day, if you can't afford to put food on your table, can't afford to get to work, can't afford a home or rent, you know, every other issue is going to be secondary, tertiary, and so forth, right? So the importance of that, like, where, yes, you have your climate story, and, you know, everyone talks about the carbon tax as an example, but this is a new issue, and you have to, like, be able to respond. And if they are successful in deploying this effectively, then people will say, look, I can give you another shot at finalizing. Otherwise, we're not going to vote for you. So that's where the challenge is. We're like, it is an issue of importance, climate change. But if I can't afford to basically take care of myself and my family, then like I need to think about this first. And that's where government has to be responsive. That like we're still going to do this climate change action, but we do need to address what you care about right now because it impacts your every day-to-day life.
Bonnie Crombie, provincial Liberal leader for Ontario, has now come out and said that there will not be a provincial carbon tax. Stop short of the other seven premiers that said we should pause or scrap it moving forward. It appears that she's trying to take the Liberal Party provincially to the center, and that eating the NDP's lunch isn't going to work anymore. Do you get the feeling that that's where this party is going, that they're trying to bring the party back to the center and less of the extreme left?
Yes, and that's for Bonnie's historical political leaning. She's very centrist, can lean a little bit more to the blue liberal side, and that's what she wants to imprint. Like she's otherwise you're kind of really looking fake, and she has a political history, so she is not sort of recreating what isn't already there. So her moving it back and being responsive, I'm sure they're doing some polling to see if this makes sense, but there is, they are trying to make sure they have an opportunity to brand Bonnie the way that they want to brand her and not to be branded as a federal Liberal or and something else that she has no control over. So to be able to control your own narrative, control your own brand, and build into what you think will be effective. So whatever the climate policy will be, she'll have to be able to say like, I built this. This is my climate policy. This is not the policy of someone else. So is going to be the effective tool for her to also demonstrate what a centrist liberal climate policy looks like.
Muhammad Ali with us, Vice President, Crestview Strategies, the ever-changing world of politics and getting the message out. Muhammad, fascinating discussion. Thanks for the time. Be well.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Do you still enjoy shopping as much as you used to? Now, I'm not really sure I enjoy shopping. I don't think I would fit in that category. Unless it's something that I really want, then I'm all in. And usually it's in and out. But there's some people that just, they totally love it. They love the sales. They get into the vibe. They love to touch, squeeze, and all that sort of stuff. And it's the experience. Are you still getting that experience? Do you still feel good about it? Or is it just like a necessity rather than something you necessarily want. And are you feeling that you're not being treated as nicely, perhaps, as you once were when you would explore the retail experience? Let's bring in Bruce Winder, retail analyst and author. Retail before, during, and after COVID-19. He's here now. Bruce, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the program.
I found this an interesting point in an interesting article, Bruce, that, again, shopping used to be more of an experience. It used to be a day out. It used to be fun. It used to be this, that, and the other. Obviously, everything changes. But do we still get that satisfaction from the customer experience like we used to?
I think it's really hit or miss. I think it really depends on the retailer. And I think mostly that satisfaction is probably coming from premium retailers or luxury retailers because they have more of the margin, more of the profit, the gross margin to be able to offer great service. Like you look at before Nordstrom left, they did a great job on service. But a lot of the other retailers, they're trying to keep their costs down because there's price pressure. There's also earnings pressure. So companies are always trying to beat last year's profits and last year's earnings. And sadly, one of the ways they keep doing it is by reducing service for customers, whether it's pushing more of the work onto customers or automating. It just feels a lot more transactional than it used to, even 20 or 30 years ago.
It sounds obvious. You want it cheap. You want to pay less. You're going to get less. Is it, in a sense, consumers' fault for demanding, the basics and then complaining when they get them?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know what? Part of it is our fault because we keep looking for cheap things and we keep buying from the cheapest retailer, right? So, when that happens, there's competition. And if you have to match prices with cheap retailers or online retailers from different continents, then you've got to take cost out of your business. The easiest way to do that is through reducing customer service. So part of it is something we've brought upon ourselves.
Smaller retailers, and we saw this during the COVID experience, that that can't necessarily compete with larger chains, prices and such. They try to outdo the others with service.
That's right. That's one of the only things they have that differentiates them from the big box stores is that personal sort of one-to-one service. And, you know, if they lose that, they lose everything. There's no reason for anyone to shop there. So that's something that, and normally you do get, back to my earlier point, you know, I was talking about luxury service. You do get great service as well. I should have mentioned it at the independents, at the mom and pop stores, because mm-hmm. they have to give it.
So much of this have to do with security issues. I mean, the story last week about whether it's the LCBO or grocery store chains that are checking your purchases before you go out the door. And the reality is we had one biz prof say, you know, you either do that or you pay higher prices for it.
Yeah, that's the reality, too. I mean, you know, I don't know why. Is it because, you know, the economy's tough, inflation's tough, wages aren't high enough, but we've seen a significant increase in shoplifting and a significant increase in what they call organized retail crime, where gangs go in and smash and grab. And retailers have had to go on the offense here and try to do some things to sort of fight for those dollars back, because there's not much profit in retail. Retail is a low margin industry. And if your theft goes up, you know, that could be your margin for the year. So that's why retailers are out there fighting. But sometimes, you know, what they're doing is at the expense of customer service.
One quote was, it's almost like it's wartime footing. We're buying things as if we had to ration them. does it take better times for that to turn around?
Geez, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, maybe when things get a little better, whether it's 25 or 26, you know, people will start to loosen up. But I think this is just the new normal. I think that we've become a polarized world where you're either a have or a have not. And the distance between the haves and have-nots is getting bigger every year. So that's putting more pressure on price. And everyone is true. Just like the article said, it's a battleground now in retail.
Is anybody doing it particularly well?
Well, I think just the mom and pops are doing it well. Some of the chains, you know, Lululemon has done very well. IKEA has done well. You know, even though they don't have a lot of people, the way they lay out their stores and the way they inform you is pretty good too. You know, there's hit or misses there. Nordstrom, like I said, even though they left Canada, they're known to be one of the best in the industry from a service standpoint. So, you know, it really depends on where you go and who you are, but there are some winners as it relates to that, but too many companies have scaled back their service to save money.
Can you see this becoming a marketing strategy? Hey, we treat you like a somebody. Boy, that sounds like it's been used.
I think that's Speedy Muffler, isn't it, or something? But
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? You're right. It is a bit of a difference in strategy, but normally you have to have higher price points to offset the increased labor cost and training to be able to do that. So I've yet to see anyone do it sort of at the value segment, but you know, you never know. Someone might be able to do it through AI or robots or something, but waiting for that to happen.
Bruce Winter, Winder, retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19, the customer experience when you hit the mall or the store. Bruce, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Yeah, anytime. Take care.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Let's bring in Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. Putin claims victory in the Russian election. Boy, that's a surprise. Elliot, thanks so much for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Oh, thank you. Same to you, Scott. Yes, what a great predictor of election outcomes he turns out to be.
Yeah, exactly. Elliot, many people are emailing me and saying, like, why do they bother doing this? Is there even any opponents? Why do they have elections like this if we know the outcome?
Well, we know the outcome, but he needs this election as a formality to show how popular he is and that he's there as a legitimate ruler with increasing levels of popularity, extremely high turnout. And indeed, underneath all that, there probably is widespread support for him. The economy is doing well. The war is going very well, according to everything he talks about. So that... Rally around the leader, and you have to fight off the Nazis, and we are the new Rome, and the West is decadent, and they're trying to hold us back, and we have to denazify Ukraine. We have to bring our Ukrainian brothers back into the Russian fold. It's a very popular election-winning exercise, but of course, this was a sham election. There were no actual leaders allowed to run. We know that Navalny was murdered in prison, etc. So he controlled every lever of every possible aspect of this election, and therefore he came through with a very high level of support.
Did anybody run against him? I mean, he didn't get 100% of the vote. So those that somebody either didn't show up or voted for somebody else, is there any option here?
Yes. He carefully selected the option, any real possibility. There was one independent candidate that got eliminated, fortunately for that candidate, by just making his application illegitimate. But no, to oppose Mr. Putin is a very risky operation. Yes, there were other names on the ballot. He carefully had selected them. They were also his own supporters, and no real opposition was permitted on this ballot.
Do Russians realize that, or this is the only thing they know, so it's normal life for them? But do they realize that we're going out here and doing nothing because he controls it all? Do they honestly think they're making a decision here or having an option?
Well, we should talk a bit about some of the implications. There was opposition in that the widow now of Mr. Navalny, Yulia Nalov, she said, yes, do vote. He apparently, Navalny himself had outlined this just before his execution in jail. So in the polar wolf penal system. So yes, he said, do vote. Everybody show up simultaneously at once at 12 noon. And if you do show up in your thousands, that will show at least something. And that did happen across the 11 time zones of Russia. And so that, you know, presumably they did not vote for Mr. Putin. We are worried for them, of course, because now they may be getting knocks on the door.
So what is next? Is life good for Vladimir Putin now? Just continue on with your day-to-day and whatever's going on in Ukraine?
I think everything's going to get worse. Not for Mr. Putin. Everything's going very well for him personally. But I think everything is going to get worse in a variety of ways. First of all, I think, Scott, the war itself is going to enter a new phase. We are today, as we are on air, at the 10th anniversary of the annexation of Crimea. Remember, this war didn't just start this March, this February. It started 10 years ago with the annexation of Crimea and some parts of the Donbass. So what's going to happen now, I suspect, is that the mobilization, basically, he's lost so many troops, probably over 300,000 and many multiples of that in terms of injuries, that he can't win this war without a whole lot more troops. His troops he's got there are exhausted. So I think very possibly there's going to be a mobilization now, that is a draft, which was politically risky. His advisors told him last time, 2022, don't do it. But military said we have to have these troops. There's likely, along with that, to be a tax increase. As part of the war itself entering a new phase, more troops, more tax dollars being put into the military, and the kinds of terrible scenes, even as simultaneously with this election, there were a vast increase, a further increase of attacks all across Ukraine. I think, second of all, repression is going to likely increase. Not only for those individuals we talked about, but anybody who might want to now protest at home or abroad. There is number three in the among Navalny's organization. A fellow named Leonid Volkov was being interviewed just before the election. Is Mr. Putin strong or weak? And he responded, "Dinosaurs were very strong before they were extinct." Very witty.
Wow.
right after that, he was in Lithuania. He's in Vilnius. He was not inside Russia. He was attacked by a man with a hammer and almost killed.
Right. Yeah.
So repression, I think, is likely to go ahead. This is an okay for a dictator to become much more of a dictator at home and abroad. I think, thirdly, the so-called axis of evil is likely to get even more strong, more visible in terms of trying to really reorient global politics. China and Russia working together, and China was very quick off the mark to congratulate him. But this also includes Iran, North Korea. India has joined in and congratulating him. The three countries in the Sahel and Africa increasingly are working with Mr. Putin. So there's the coalition of forces opposed to the status quo in the Western, not just Western, but global democracy is likely, I think, to get even more challenged. And it's entirely possible as part of this, influence operations are also likely to get even bolder than they have, keeping in mind that we know that Russia has interfered in the American election in the past. He's very much he says the opposite, but he really would like to have, of course, Mr. Trump come back in power. But also he plans to, I think, weaken NATO and EU using influence operations. This election is simply going to make the existing situation worse in all of these dimensions and maybe even more.
Elliot Tepper with us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. Putin continues his reign. Elliot, as always, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. Same to you, Scott.
You know, I think this this issue changed for a lot of people in a post-COVID-19 world and how they want to end up in life, whether it is in the home that they are in currently and can they stay there for the rest of time, nursing home, retirement home. What are those options? Many have decided they don't want any of the above and have tried something pretty creative and outside the box where how about senior roommates and creating your own scenario? Let's bring in Pat Dunn, founder and executive director of Senior Women Living Together, and is with us now. Pat, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. Thank you, Scott, and it's wonderful to be here.
So tell us about Senior Women Living Together. What's this all about? Tell us about your organization.
Okay, well, we're a nonprofit, and we have opened a website, and we have a Facebook group. And on the website, women can come and find other senior women that they're compatible with and decide to live together and find a rental to live in.
This sounds like a great idea as, you know, many are living much longer than we used to do and don't necessarily want to go with traditional options. Is this a new idea? Is there a lot of people that are thinking outside the box this way?
Well, I think there are more and more, certainly. The idea of co-living or shared living isn't new. Around the world, it's quite popular. It's not so much in North America, but I think it's coming. And certainly even younger folks who are struggling, you know, with any possibility of purchasing a home, they have to save money. And so they're starting to live together, young professionals and other younger people. So it's starting to come around in North America as well.
Yeah, you're bringing up a valid point. There's lots of young people who are trying to get the first home that are doing this. So obviously, if it works for them, why not for seniors? What can this look like? What is the majority of the arrangements? How does this work out?
Okay, well, most of our success stories are two person. They've found one other person they want to live with, yeah. And then a rental place to live in together. We do have some that are three person. Mine is an example of that. I live with two other senior women in a house, and we're starting to get more four person ones. We have two 4-person groups now that are success stories, and a third one on the way. So that I think comes out of a need to financial need for more than anything. It's the cheapest way to go, the more people you live with.
It just seems like a great idea. What are some of the challenges that you face when you do this? Because obviously there's legalities involved over and above personality and such. How do you make sure you're not getting yourself into a situation that you regret?
Well, you know, it's a bit like getting married that way. There's a bit of a leap of faith to some extent. But we do have a lot of training on the website and information on how to determine compatibility. We encourage them to spend a lot of time together before they actually start living together. And then they create a homemade agreement, which is not a legal document, but it's a social contract between the group. And they decide about everything, cooking, cleaning, laundry, whether or not you're going to have guests, how the pets will be managed. It goes through absolutely everything, including things like aging. As you know, what if one of us gets sick? What if one of us has to go to long-term care? All of those things are discussed ahead of time in the homemade agreement.
You know, it's interesting, Pat, because I think a lot of people have a hard time discussing any of that anyway. Maybe this is the vehicle to actually, hey, we can control our own destiny here, but you got to talk about it. You got to make the decisions.
Yeah, exactly. And some of us joke about how we might never have gotten married had we done this.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Kind of, because, you know, you talk about things that are going to happen in a relationship when you live together and you get it all talked out at first.
That's a great idea. So I'm guessing that, is there a common template or is every one of these situations different in some way?
Everyone is different because they're very individual. I mean, this is all about choice. One thing we start to lose as we get older is our freedom to choose. And so it was very important to me when I started this that the women would be able to choose who they want to live with, where they want to live, and what kind of housing they want to live in. And so making all those choices takes time and gets complex. And just compatibility alone is a complex choice. So, there's lots of challenges along the way.
I don't know if this is an odd question, Pat. Are you allowed to bring your husband or is this just women?
This is all women, yeah. Right. We focused on women, well, because at the time, and now in the last census, 2021, there are 895,000 single senior women living in unaffordable housing in Ontario.
Yeah.
I think we have enough to do with just women at this point.
How long have you been together with this organization? How long has this organization been up and running?
I'm the founder. I started it into February of 2019. And we've since become a nonprofit organization in August of the same year. And in 2021, we opened the website.
And what's the response been like?
Pretty good. There's a lot more people joining our Facebook group where we're just talking about it and discussing it, because I think it does take some time to adopt the whole idea and, you know, feel confident to move forward. But currently we have between 400 and 500 on our website who are actively looking. Now that's all across Ontario. So we've got lots and lots. That's why I love to talk about it with you and others, because there's lots and lots of women out there that would like to do this, but don't even know we exist. So hopefully these programs like yours help.
So can you see how this will change long-term care moving forward, or even how we build long-term care moving forward?
Well, very good question, Scott. Yes, I do see it changing. Most seniors do not want to go into long-term care. They want to age in place in the communities they live in. But it's just not affordable for too many. So I think the smaller, there's a group of people looking at, and builders looking at, smaller, like 10 to 12 or maybe 15 seniors in one housing unit with separate place, you know, bedrooms and so on, and making them smaller and more community, more like a family. And I think that sort of structure will start to come into play.
I know of a builder up north in cottage country that, and you know, the farther you get out of the city, the less services there are, that's doing something like this and building like six units together. And the whole idea is people want to stay in town, but they just don't want to care for homes anymore. They want a simpler way of life. Is this really starting to go beyond, say, this organization and into the building industry?
Well, I talk with builders a lot. They contact me to get ideas about, you know, what are the components that seniors are going to want in these sorts of structures. Building, unfortunately, anything is very expensive now because the materials are very expensive. Mm-hmm. So there'll always be an expense issue. I think if the government wants to save money, and they definitely will, if they support organizations like mine and builders that are interested in doing this and create a long-term care that and an age-in-place situation that keeps people out of hospitals and out of the expensive medical units.
Great work. Pat Dunn with us, founder and executive director, Senior Women Living Together. Don't want to go the traditional route. Senior roommates, basically. Pat, great idea. Good luck with this moving forward.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Coming up after the 6 o'clock news, Scott Radley Show. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am. Well, other than the snow, where did snow come from? But yes, other than the snow, I'm fine.
You know why it's snowing?
Because the Around the Bay race is coming up this weekend, and so we have to bring the temperature down. I don't know.
That's very good. I was going to say, because tomorrow's the first day of spring.
Yeah, well, that too. No, that too. But
Did you realize that?
I had kind of forgotten.
Yeah, it snuck up on me.
I've been calling it spring since February, though, because it's felt that way until now, until spring came, and now we get the snow.
That's it. So get the skis out. It's time to go tobogganing and everything. All right. So, you know, I don't know what you want to talk about today, because there's so much stuff going on. But this is one thing that here, let me get that. This is one thing that kind of stood out to me. And I don't think a lot of people have been talking about this. But the Von Mayor, Stephen Del Duca, is looking towards a bylaw that will do something to try to get control of the aggressive and unlawful protests that are going on that turn into big demonstrations of hate. Obviously, protesting is one thing. It's certainly part of our constitution. It's what you're allowed to do. But once you start ending up in hospitals and places of worship and harassing people that are outside, it's a different story. He's looking to put in place a bylaw that says you can't go within 100 meters of an institution or what have you with one of these protests. Do you think this is the way to go? Do you think this is, because he's really the first one to speak up about this?
You know, and I would have to look at Vaughn's bylaws. My guess is that the stuff that he's talking about is already covered in either bylaws or the criminal code. I mean, if you have police, if someone says something that is hateful, you have police and you have the capacity and the mechanism to charge that person. And I don't know if the idea is that, well, it's very complicated and then we have to go through the court system and we're not going to win, so a bylaw is just a simpler thing to do to try and clear them out. Okay, maybe if that's the case. But to me, this is somewhat, it's not exactly the same, but it's somewhat like when our city council a year or two ago put that bylaw together for the big party, big street party bylaw. Every single element of that was already existing within our bylaws. You merely collated it into one big thing and said, okay, now we can do something about it. So, I mean, it seems to me that if we're having a protest that is causing problems as far as hate speech or whatever else, that stuff is already covered. And if it's not saying hateful things, then that's permitted within our rules of law. So, I mean, I'll be very interested to see how they finesse something like this to not be unconstitutional, but to say, but we don't really want to charge you with hate, even though what you're saying is hate, if that's what they're saying.
You know, I think what I find interesting too is if any of this action that we've been seeing, and whether it's threatening police officers or what have you, if anything, any of this had gone on during the Freedom Convoy, we'd be having a completely different discussion right now. It makes the convoy look like a circus, a bouncy castle. I mean, if this had happened during that attack, there'd be hell to pay.
It does. Look, I understand that people in Ottawa were totally fed up with horns honking and streets closed and all that. I understand that. And so, you know, it's like a lot of other things. It's not entirely apples to apples, but it did seem as though, especially in retrospect now that you have something sort of to compare it to, sort of, that there was, as you say, a different standard. And you know, I mean, I can recall, as you can, as everyone listening can, the outrage when someone put a trucker flag or whatever it was. What did they do on the Terry Fox statue? And it's like, I understand. I don't want them defacing the Terry Fox statue and dragging him into a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there was such outrage about that. And then, you know, what was the response? Remember the Eaton Center a few months ago when the guy was basically threatening people with a cop right there? And nothing. Yeah. And I know some people were upset, but not officially, not from, you know, not the officials getting into it. The police were right there. So I don't know. It seems to me that we do, I don't know, Scott, do you think it's got something to do with the fact that the police have been told, don't exacerbate this because we're afraid where this might go? And is that not, I don't know if the word is abdicating your job. I'm thinking your job as a police officer is to keep the peace and maintain the laws regardless of who's doing it or what the outcome might be, but apparently not.
It's their job is to keep the peace. And then as soon as a protest's involved, then for some reason it becomes political. But yeah, you have to wonder what that line is, what line needs to be crossed, what needs to be the threshold where all of a sudden, and maybe it's the mayor speaking up of Vaughan and saying we need some sort of bylaw.
Well, but really quickly, if the idea is we can't do anything at some of these protests because we don't want to inflame it.
Bylaws will do nothing.
Not only will bylaws not do much, but would that not suggest that the truckers should have been more menacing and then they would not have been cleared out because we don't want to inflame the situation? That seems like the worst possible message you could possibly ever send.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great show, Scott. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Steve via email on the Prime Minister's job being too hard. Countries are laughing at me. My jet airplanes are old. I can't walk out on the street without being harassed. My party is constantly being challenged by the opposition and personal attacks every day. They used to laugh and call me names. I leave work every day feeling demoralized. Nobody understands me. Whatever should I do? Resign, says Steve, and keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.